This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
In 1002, a young Norman woman crossed the Channel from northern France. She was on her way to marry the English king, Ethelred. We don't know whether she spoke any English. We're not certain about her age, at most in her early 20s, perhaps as young as her early teens. She came to marry a man turned 30. She was his second, possibly his third wife. The young woman was Emma, sister of the Norman Count. She's often remembered as the woman who made the fateful link between England and Normandy, this marriage the first step towards the conquest of 1066 and the end of Anglo-Saxon England. But all that's hindsight. She'd be powerful, though that power would wax and wane. She'd go on to witness the defeat of her Anglo-Saxon husband by a Danish conqueror, Canute, and she'd marry that conqueror. She'd be a low-profile wife and mother during Ethelred's reign, then act as a sort of regent for the Danish Canute. She'd have three sons with two different fathers, and she'd be involved in a great political struggle to place one of them on the English throne after Canute's death. She'd be exiled as a result, but then return with her Danish son in triumph. But triumph would be darkened by accusations that she was guilty of the death of another son, that she'd invited back her son with Ethelred during the struggle, reckless of his safety. And when his brother came to the throne, she'd be deprived of her lands. At first sight, Emma shocks us, marrying her husband's conqueror, separated as a result from several of her children, perhaps not even seeing them for nearly two decades. Emma's career invites the sort of response politically active women often get, ruthless, ambitious, pursuing her own ends at the expense of all else, prepared to invite back her own sons into danger rather than give up the role of Queen Mother to another woman after Canute's death. And sure, Emma can't have been a retiring violet. But our job is to understand her, and that means understanding the political world in which she moved and how that world worked for women. Emma of Normandy is in many ways typical of the wives of Anglo-Saxon kings, especially in her life lived out amid the politics of family. She stands at the apogee of Anglo-Saxon queenship, but she also shows us what a precarious peak that was. Family politics dominated Emma's life. She was always primarily the wife, mother or widow of kings. Men operated in that politics too, but women's lives were much more determined by them. So Emma first appeared on the English stage as a wife and continued as that until Canute's death over three decades later. She acted after Canute's death as a mother, fighting for her son's claims on the throne, and that would have been seen as perfectly acceptable. That was what mothers should do. Emma acted out the roles this politics demanded. It was a primary job of a royal wife to become a mother, especially a mother of sons. Emma had sons with Ethelred and Canute. It was a primary role of a widow to keep alive the memory of her dead husband, and Emma did that too. A book was written and presented to her in widowhood. But what happens if you had two husbands? As a widow, do you cultivate the memory of both of them, when the second was the conqueror of the first? That book that was written for Emma quietly passes over her first husband, Ethelred, altogether. He isn't even named in it. After a husband's death, you're a widow, but still a mother. Are you expected to retire gracefully and cultivate your husband's tomb, or fight for your sons? And what happens when you've got three sons by two different husbands, all of whom had claims on the English throne, but who were rivals for it? That was Emma's situation after Canute's death. All three of her sons, two with Ethelred and one with Canute, had claims. That book, which was written for her, tries to present her as working for all of them. It makes for a tortuous argument in the book, because it was a tortuous life the book was recording. Emma's life, then, was lived out within these politics, and they gave her, as we'll see, some of her greatest moments. But they were far from easy to navigate. They were not designed to deliver power to women, even if they often did. They offered no easy answers to the complications of family. It's often difficult to decide whether a woman like Emma is a pawn and victim or a mover and player, And that's because family politics made her both, at different stages of her career. Marriages, royal marriages especially, were political. They weren't love matches, they were about alliances between men and about getting sons and heirs. Emma's first marriage to Ethelred was especially about alliance. This wasn't a marriage primarily about producing an heir. Ethelred had 10 children already. Emma didn't carry quite the same anxious burden as Princess Diana did, or as the Duchess of Cambridge perhaps does now. Ethelred already had plenty of children and, most important, plenty of sons. Having sons would still have mattered to her, to secure her in the family. But this was a marriage about English external politics. England had been under attack by Danish raiders for over a decade. Normandy was a haven for them. Ethelred wanted to close Norman ports to his enemies, so he sought a Norman bride. It was an unusual choice for unusual times. No English king had married a non-Anglo-Saxon woman for 150 years. Her second marriage to Ethelred's conqueror Canute was also about politics. It made obvious sense from a conqueror's point of view. It might keep her Norman relatives quiet and stop them supporting her sons with Ethelred. Canute could sell it to his own followers as a final humiliation of the English. We've taken their king's widow. He'd have found her knowledge of English politics very useful. And if she spoke Danish, and as a Norman she probably did, that was just a bonus. He could actually understand her. But what about Emma? Is this marriage to Canute the first evidence of a ruthless woman reluctant to relinquish power and position? More likely she was a virtual prisoner. As one source puts it, Canute ordered her to be fetched. When she looked back on the marriage 25 years or so later, Emma portrayed it as one of equals, said she'd had bargaining power and freedom, but we all write our lives with the benefit of hindsight. In 1017, Emma was caught up in the politics of marriage, and conquest made them even more brutal than in 1002. Women, even royal women, were at their least free at the point of marriage. But bride is one thing, wife another. A wife could be powerful, though not always, as Emma's two marriages show. As Ethelred's wife, she was not especially prominent. Her foreignness must have made her an object of suspicion. She was married because she was Norman. But the marriage didn't end the Danish raids. They just grew in ferocity and success. And as a Norman, Emma looked part Danish. The Norman counts were descended from Vikings. But as wife of Canute, her fortunes changed. Ironically, the coerced bride became the powerful partner in rule. Few other Anglo-Saxon royal wives can match her importance during Canute's reign. At court, she's up there with the king, soon outranking even the two archbishops. She became a great patron of churches like Winchester and Canterbury. And again, circumstances were critical. Emma's new husband was a conqueror. He was also an imperial ruler with kingdoms in Scandinavia and foreign wars which often took him away. He needed his wife. In his absence, she was his alter ego. Maybe not quite a formal regent, but his powerful representative. Emma, alongside Canute, was the wife's partner. She realised the potential of the role to the nth degree. No wonder this was the husband and the period of her life she later chose to remember. We catch those memories in that book I've referred to, what we now call the Encomium of Emma. It's partly a work of apologia, an explanation of Emma's actions during the seven-year-long succession dispute which broke out on Canute's death. And it presents the dilemmas of motherhood, at least the dilemmas for a woman who had sons by different royal husbands, all of whom wanted to be king. That succession dispute pitted Emma's sons against each other and against another son of Canute, by another woman. Emma labelled that woman a concubine, but defining the status of a sexual partner was still a grey area in the 11th century, even though Christian definitions of marriage were tightening. Canute was close to polygamous. He had a wife before he married Emma, and she and her son were still around to contest the throne. The struggle for the throne after Canute's death was exceptionally complicated. There is a famous picture of Emma, the frontispiece to the Encomium. In it she's shown, large and seated. The author of the book presents it to her, whilst her two sons, one by Canute, one by Ethelred, peep in at the side. It represents the trinity of rule, which is the culmination of the book, a mother and sons together. That was Emma's ultimate maternal pipe dream. The encomium claimed Emma supported all her sons during these years. Edward, her son with Ethelred, probably didn't believe it. And it was Emma's misfortune that her Danish son died early, and it was Edward who finally became king. That picture also shows her crowned. Queenship was the final aspect of Emma's position, and it's clearly one which mattered a lot to her. She was not a queen as Elizabeth II is, not a ruler in her own right. Emma was a queen consort, a king's wife, like the last queen mother, or as the Duchess of Cambridge will someday be. But like them, she was more than just a wife. A queen was crowned and anointed, and crowning and anointing for a woman meant more then than it does now. It's no coincidence that at the height of her power during Canute's reign, Emma was almost invariably called Queen Regina. The title captures all the most formal aspects of her position. Queenship was a parallel to kingship, a kind of office. It had none of the uniqueness of kingship. A son could marry, could produce a new queen, to eclipse or replace his mother, even before her death, which is just what Edward did. When he became king, he married and had his new wife crowned and anointed. This son of Ethelred and Emma had little to thank his mother for, but he would have married in any case. Emma retired and spent her last years quietly in Winchester until her death in March 1052. A royal wife and mother, even a queen, could not halt the unfolding of the life cycle of family politics. Taking stock of Emma, it sometimes looks as if she just had too much of everything, an embarrassment of sons, of husbands. Hers looks like a life of accident, of conquests, of absences, of early deaths. As Lady Bracknell might have put it, to lose one husband looks like misfortune, to lose two looks like carelessness. But accidents happen in wider contexts, and lives are lived out according to roles and scripts written by deeper structures. Taking stock of Emma means taking stock of being a late Anglo-Saxon queen, royal wife and mother. The politics of 10th and 11th century England were her context. A wealthy England, desirable as a prize to foreign conquerors. An England in a wider European setting, already deeply affected by events in Scandinavia or northern France. An England which had recently seen religious movements, which had enhanced the position of kings and queens. Emma's life was written by queenship, but even more by what it meant to be an 11th century wife, mother, widow. Family was central to politics. The kingdom was in some senses a family firm, where wives could be partners in ruling and not just round the hearth. Succession to the throne was not cut and dried. There was room for argument and manoeuvre, and mothers had a legitimate political role in fighting for their sons' inheritance. Unfortunately, the ideals of wife, mother, widow didn't allow for multiple husbands, rival wives, or sons with different men. Life is more complicated than ideal scripts allow, and lives don't come much more complicated than Emma's.